contact is effective if you can.
Oh, no. Okay.
Okay, we are very happy to have Professor Fried here. He's going to talk about self-duality, K-theory, and oriented force.
Thank you. Pleasure to be back here again. So what I'm going to talk about today is joint work in progress with Jacques Distler. And Greg Moore. So, I want to talk about orientifolds, and I think we have two main things to say about orientifolds. The first thing to say is that that orientifolds in the physics literature are kind of, there's a zoo of them with lots of different cases and so on. And I think one of the things we have to say is just to organize that data of what an orientifold is. It's some kind of string background. And so the first part of the lecture, I'll certainly be trying to explain what the data is that defines an orientifold. And then the theorem has to do with comparing something at high energy and low energy. And it fits in with the general idea, which is the following, that the high energy theory, which in this case is the perturbative string, well, that's a theory that's meant to make sense of high energies or very small distances. And then you want to ask the question, what does that theory look like at larger distance or lower energy? And so in physics, there's a definite arrow from high energy to low energy, where you try to make a low energy theory that it might look very different, that approximates this high energy theory, that explains how it behaves at low energy. So this low energy theory wouldn't be good for making calculations at high energy, but it applies at low energy. So I'd rather think of that in terms of distance, that this is a small distance scale, and this is a theory on a large distance scale. And so the theory that's here is a field theory on some 10 manifolds, so in 10 dimensions. Whereas the variables here, the string, has to do with should I switch to a mathematical book?
What I just understand is that there are a lot of physics graduate students.
All right. Anyway, these words are for the mathematicians. The physicists all know this. So so on this side, we have functions of two variables, if you like, functions on a Riemann surface, whereas on this side, functions in 10 variables. That's very different. So the standard example physicists give is you might describe the dynamics of water by having a system where the variables are each molecule of water. That would be a very small distance theory. But if you wanted to describe the effective theory at long distance, you might just have a single function that described a wave. And you're supposed to deduce the behavior of that wave from this molecular theory. So in the same way, you're supposed to deduce the behavior of this low energy field theory from the perturbative string. Well, one of the
ideas. What dimension is the left hand side?
It's really a two-dimensional theory, because it's a theory of on Riemann surfaces.
Oh, it's not a theory of maps of Riemann surfaces.
Well, maps into some target, but the kind of functions are functions of two variables. So you think of them as fields on a Riemann surface.
Ten-dimensional fields?
Yeah, like 10 functions of two variables, right? I mean, that would locally be a map from the surface to the 10 manifold. But the 10 isn't as important, I mean. What's important from the point of view of how it behaves is that it's two variables. So so one of the things that you can see at all these scales that's constant that you can compare is the topology. So if there's some kind of topological thing you might measure at high energy, you might expect to measure it here. And that's somehow an old idea. I think Ed Hooft might be one of the first ones, but I wouldn't really know who. There's a particular topological feature called an anomaly, essentially, which he matches in the high energy and low energy theory and uses it as a guide to understand what form this low energy theory should be to describe this high energy theory. And so what I'll describe today is an example of that kind of principle of using topology to understand how to match this low energy theory to the high energy theory. I should say, just as a general comment, that I think that as mathematicians, you know, one of the things we do understand well about quantum field theory is that kind of thing. We understand topology and we can see it in the high energy and low energy theories. That's something. Topology is scale independent. I mean, you make a homotopy, you don't change topological invariants. And even more, and of course more sophisticated mathematics enters if you do conformal field theories. Well, conformal field theories are, again, field theories that look the same at all scales. That's what it means to be conformal. And I think the part we really don't understand in mathematics is understanding things which change when you change scale, and really understanding how to handle those. So the particular thing that that we're going to discuss in here is what's called Ramon-Ramon charge. So you can think of this as some kind of analog in this theory of what electric charge is in classical electromagnetism. And so you can measure, you know, there are lots of things that might be charged in electromagnetism. You might have particles that are charged. You could have fields that are charged. And in string theory, there are objects which are charged called D-brains, which we won't discuss today. But what's curious about this orientifold system is that there's already a charge due to the kind of gravitational background in the theory. And so what we're going to really compare is what we might call a gravitational Ramon-Ramon charge. So when we set up the manifold, I give you this data, then there will already be a charge present in the theory, a current and a charge. And so that's what we're going to be comparing. Now, on this side, this Ramon-Ramon charge was computed for orientifolds. This background charge in the high energy theory, so in the string theory, perturbative string. In a paper by Morales, Skruka, Cerrone. And so there's some formula which involves polynomials in the curvature, like a hat and things like that, but they're actually slightly different polynomials in the curvature. And anyway, they derived this formula quite a while ago, and there are lots of physics papers. I won't try to think of all the people who've talked about those formulas. And what we're going to do is derive those formulas, and that's what I want to explain in this low energy field theory, and explain what's the input that goes into describing those formulas. So that's what I want to explain. All right. So what is an orientifold? So what's the data? Well, X will be a smooth 10 manifold, which I'll always take to be compact, so I can integrate over it eventually. And it will have a spin structure. So you can think it has a metric, too. So I know what the spin group is. But the particular choice of the metric won't matter. And then what makes this an orientifold is that we have an involution, sigma. This is an involution, which means that sigma squared is the identity on X. And we should think that the space-time in the theory is the quotient of X by this involution sigma. So you think of sigma as identifying different points of this X, so the real physical space would somehow be the quotient of X by sigma. Okay. Now, there's a dichotomy right away, because we might have that sigma preserves or reverses the orientation of X, and that's called type, if it preserves, it's called type B, and if it reverses, it's called type A. So there's a type B string and a type A string. And here, then we want sigma to preserve or reverse the orientation. Okay, well, I didn't say how sigma interacts with the spin structure. And so what we need is a lift. So let's first do the case where sigma preserves the orientation. Well, you see, in that case, then sigma is a map from x to x. And over x, we have, let me leave myself in the front. So over x, we have the bundle of oriented frames, right? And if we differentiate sigma, then it gives me a map from the oriented frames to the oriented frames. So instead of moving points, I move vectors, and I move a whole frame of vectors. So sigma, its derivative, induces a map on frames. Now, the spin structure is a double cover of this frame bundle. And so what I want to require is that the sigma actually lifts to there. So that's a restriction on the involution, that it actually lifts to the spin bundle. Okay, and so that's an additional piece of data, is actually specifying this lift. And then we might have that if I take this lift and square it, then what do I get? Well, I get a transformation that certainly covers the identity here, but this is a double cover, and so it's either the identity or it's the Deck transformation. So in other words, I might have that sigma tilde has order either 2 or 4. So when I square it, I might not quite get the identity. I would get the Deck transformation. So again, we have a dichotomy here among the type B cases. And today, we're going to really focus, I'm going to tell you more details about the story where it really lifts to be of order 2. So that's the case in which this manifold is equivariantly spin. The spin structure is preserved by this involution. Okay. If, maybe I should just mention briefly, if sigma reverses the orientation, well, then we don't have a lift to the oriented frames, but just to all frames, the orthogonal frame bundle. So now sigma lifts to here, but when I take a frame and I transform it by sigma, the frame reverses orientation. So we can again ask for a lift, but a lift to what? Well, we have to lift now to another double cover, and this is a pin structure rather than a spin structure. So I'm afraid in this orientifold game, we have to remember about the double cover, not just of the special orthogonal group, but of the orthogonal group. And in fact, if we remember the double cover of the orthogonal group, there are actually two different double covers in the orthogonal group. They sit inside the two possible Clifford algebras, which have two different signs. And the correct one here is a group we might call pin minus, which sits inside the Clifford algebra, where the gamma squares are negative 1. Anyway, I'm not going to discuss in detail this case, but I will mention a little bit right now about sort of formulating this in a better way. So again, in this case, we might have that sigma tilde has order 2 or order 4. So somehow there are four basic cases of this orientifold depending on these various dichotomies. So let me just give you a what I would say is a more elegant formulation, maybe slightly speculative. But I told you from the beginning that we should think of the quotient of x by sigma. And let me give that a name. So let's call the quotient of x by sigma what we might think, x mod sigma. Now, if I think of that as just a topological space, then I'm losing information, of course. If sigma acts freely, that's fine. This is, again, a nice smooth 10 manifold. But if sigma doesn't act freely, then there are fixed points on x. And at those fixed points, there's an isotropy group. And we want to really remember that. So we should think of the quotient in a more sophisticated sense. So we should think of the quotient as, well, what in differential geometry, I think, was originally called V-manifold, and then got the name orbifold. But the term orbifold is used in string theory to mean a construction in string theory. And in algebraic geometry, such a thing is called the linea Mumford stack. And so we can think of this as a smooth version of a Delinea-Mumford stack. So it's any of those. I think in differential geometry we would use the word orbifold more easily. And so in this formulation, so I want to say definition, a string background is the following data. So the first piece of data is this x. And instead of asking that it be a quotient of a smooth manifold by an involution, we'll just say in general that this is a smooth orbifold, or I'll use this term, a smooth Delinea-Mumford stack. So locally it has the form of dimension 10. So that means locally it's a piece of R10, a 10 ball modulo the action of a finite group. Okay, so locally it looks like that. So the second piece of data is just an integer I'll call R, which is either 0 or 1, and that corresponds to type B or type A. So I said there's a dichotomy, there are two kinds of theories, and we need to encode that. Third piece of data is a double cover I'll call it X sub W. So this is a double cover, which over here in this case the double cover was our manifold X, double covering the quotient, and it's given by a double cover is always a cohomology class with values in H1, element of H1 with Z2 coefficients. So this double cover is what's telling us about the orientifold. And the last piece of data that I'll mention is what we might call a sort of twisted pin minus structure on this space-time X. And so that's what you see here. You see in the basic case we're going to discuss that actually this quotient is spin, which meant that the X is equivariantly spin. But these other cases, it might not quite even be pin minus. It might have order 4 there. And so it's a twisted motion. And in fact, we could say precisely, you see, having that is giving a precise constraint on the relation between this double cover and the Stiefel-Whitney classes of X. And so I should say that the constraint is that W1 of X is equal to R times W, and W1 squared plus W2 of X, this is equal to, well, there are two cases, it might be 0 or W squared. So there are two possible flavors of this. So the pin minus case is the ordinary pin minus is just the condition that W1 squared plus W2 be 0. Okay. Yes? Yes.
And are those defined for orbifolds?
So I should confess that that this part of the talk has elements in both mathematics and physics. It has the mathematician's instincts to want to kind of conceptualize and formulate things in an elegant way, and it has the physicist's instinct to want to speculate. So it's only quite recently, and I won't even tell you exactly how recently, that we've formulated it in this way. So I haven't thought in detail through such a question, but I think the answer is surely yes.
Oh, really? I've been worried about elements of order 2 and local groups.
Well, that's okay. I mean, imagine that I had a global quotient, for example, here, where I would have had an element of order 2 at a fixed point. Then all this would mean is the equivariant Stiefel-Whitney classes of the equivariant tangent bundle on the total space. So I mean, certainly for a global quotient, everything I'm saying. Yeah, so.
Let me just one thing about your notation. Did you actually mean the number 3 there, that was fixed point 3 in volition? 2 to 1? Because on the other blackboard that you just erased, you were talking about involutions that might have fixed points. And now I see a double cover, but I expected to see, by analogy, a branched cover or something.
Oh, I see. Well, that's a branched cover if I think of that as a space. But if I thought of this quotient, if I think of this quotient as a space, that's a kind of branched cover, I agree.
Yeah.
But when I think of it as a stack or an orbifold, then I think it's honestly a 2 to 1 covering.
Oh, well, then maybe I didn't understand what the definition of first cohomology was. So that's not first cohomology as a space, but it's
more. No. First cohomology is a stack. Cohomology. Yeah, that explains your question, sure. Yeah, it means the orbifold cohomology.
Oh.
So, but that's a good thing. Let me just write it down. So you should think of the case when X is a global quotient of a manifold by a discrete group. I mean, the group needn't be finite and the manifold compact. We might realize it by a non-compact manifold and a discrete group. But the discrete group would have to have sort of finite stabilizers to be of that type. And then in that case, when we're talking about the cohomology of X, we mean the equivariant cohomology of this X, and when we come to talk about K-theory, the same thing. And so it's certainly more than sufficient to think about those examples, and today, after this little digression, I'm just going to restrict to this case anyway, when it's just X mod and involution. But, I said this is a definition of a string background, and of course, there's more here. There's a metric, what physicists call a dilaton, which is simply a scalar function. And then there's a more interesting gadget called a B-field. And again, unless you ask me afterwards, I'm not going to tell you in this lecture what the B-field is, but I'm happy to do so later. And I think that probably is all the data of a string background. So I want to...
Is it a very rough idea that all these singularities are supposed to be the brains?
No, so I should say that this talk is about closed strings in that language, and so it's about gravitational things, which are part of the closed string. And the brains come when you consider open strings. So you do need brains in these theories, but these singularities are, I don't know, they're just models that the physicists build. And so what I want to say is, you know, here's a kind of general.
So what was the reason they couldn't get what they wanted out of manifolds? So they started talking about these orbifolds, basically.
Yeah, I think it dates back to the time when they were trying to construct honest models using, say, the heterotic string or something, and construct models with low Euler number, which was necessary to match the number of generations of some elementary particles. And they started looking at tori mod finite groups, or things mod a extension of a lattice.
So that explains the stack part of it, but where does this involution come from? What part of
the orientifold. Right. Well, that was motivated by, again, having sort of a richer class of models to be able to cancel certain charges, I think, when they were building models. So this construction somehow came up. And so the way I'm presenting it here, I really want to think of it as a slight twist of just the usual construction, twisted by this W.
My impression of the history is that the type 2B models were formulated independently first, and it was subsequently realized.
That's certainly true, yeah. So let me...
One was a 2-1 quotient.
Yeah, that's certainly true, and maybe I should say, for the benefit of physicists, how this data correlates with the usual, say, standard cases, right? I should tell you at least what the standard cases are. So the standard cases, well, first of all, there's the type 2 string, and in the type 2 string, X is simply a smooth 10 manifold. And this R tells you whether it's type 2A or 2B. And W is equal to 0. So that means this is the trivial double cover, but it's as if it weren't there. And then notice what these equations say, that if W is 0, it just says that the manifold is spin. So this smooth manifold, which is spin. And so that's the typical data for type 2. And the type 1 case, well, the type 1 case x is equal to, let's say, x10 smooth mod the trivial involution, which as a stack is x cross a point mod the trivial involution. So that stack might be called the classifying space of Z mod 2. For example, what's a vector bundle over the stack? It's just a representation of Z mod 2. So the stack is that, and the W is equal to the generator of H1 of point Z mod 2 with Z mod 2 coefficients. So you could think of this as a space as RP infinity, and this is just the usual class in the cohomology of RP infinity. Right, so that's type 1. And I should say in that case R is equal to 0. And, well, if R is equal to 0, then you see that this x, again, has to be spin. So this x is, again, spin. Of course, for an orbifold of type 2, we just, instead of taking this to be smooth, we could take it to be, for example, the global quotient that I talked about before. So this general thing is some kind of hybrid of an orbifold and an orientifold. And so let me just say one thing about formulating the perturbative string. The string is, well, it's given by sigma, so the world sheet, I should say, of the string. So sigma is a, I hate to say, pin minus 2 manifold, again, compact surface. And so I want it to have, again, this kind of funny structure, not spin but pin, which means it needn't be oriented. And then we're going to look at maps of sigma into this space-time. And, well, again, we have to know what this means. So, for example, if this is a global quotient of x mod gamma, then what this means is we take a cover of sigma with group gamma, a Galois cover, or a principal gamma bundle, and we have a gamma equivariant map into the global x. So let me write that. If x equals x mod gamma, this is, we have sigma, and then we have a cover with group gamma, needn't be connected, of course, neither sigma be connected, and a map into x is a map into this x, which is gamma equivariant. So this thing is gamma equivariant. So this is phi, and this is some lift, phi tilde. So that's what that space of maps is, but it has to satisfy the condition that W1 of sigma, so I said it needn't be oriented, but that's constrained to be phi star of W. And so, in fact, it's a little bit stronger. What it says is that we have this X, and remember we have this double cover, this particular double cover picked out, this XW, and we have sigma mapping into X, and now there's a particular double cover of sigma, which is the orientation double cover. Any manifold has a canonical double cover. It's orientation double cover. And this map phi has to be given as an equivariant map up there. So that's the real meaning. And so now I don't have time, but I'll let you go through. And you can see, for example, in these cases, what that turns out to be. So for example, in type 2, this condition, well, this W is equal to 0, and so that says that sigma is oriented. And you know that type 2 is a theory of oriented strings. And you can see that for type 1, there would be no constraint at all. We would have all maps of all oriented and unoriented surfaces. And for the the general kind of string background, we would get that particular space of maps. Okay. So So I think that, although we haven't done it in detail, but I think we could formulate the entire sort of NSR string, the standard string, using precisely that data. So I'd like to think that any kind of string background, and as I say, there's a zoo with lots of names, type 1, type 2, orbifold, orientifold, and so on, but all those different cases could be subsumed under this kind of structure. Okay, so now let's talk about the low energy theory. So this is, as I said, a field theory on X. But now we're going to assume for the rest of the lecture that X is really this quotient of X mod sigma, and that this is spin. So in other words, X is again a compact spin manifold, and sigma is this involution. And it preserves the spin structure, and not only that, but it has a lift of order 2. So this entire situation is what we would call equivariantly. That X is equivariantly spin. Compact's necessary because I'm going to write some integrals over X. And so just to not talk about worrying about that. Okay. Yeah, so, sorry, I meant to comment on what Dave said was that, you know, people used to talk about, I don't know, four or five types of string theories, but, I mean, going back, you know, at the late 70s, people were doing supergravity theories, and already just from the representation theory of Poincaré, super Poincaré algebras, it's an easy exercise in the representation theory, to see that in 10 dimensions there are a few different representations that might lead to nonlinear theories that give you linear things. And those were called type 1 and type 2a and b. I mean, those different representations occur. And then supergravity theories that sort of realized those representations were constructed. And then around that time, Schwartz and Green and other string theorists, this was the day when there weren't so many string theorists, realized that the low energy approximation to some of the string theories they constructed were exactly these supergravities. So the classification of those names date from that period. Okay, well, the important character in the low energy theory is this Ramond-Ramond field. And this is a gauge field. So as I said at the beginning, it's analogous to kind of generalization of the Maxwell field. And so this field has two properties that you have to come to grips with. One is that that there's charge quantization. So, you know, in classical electromagnetism, an electric particle might have any real number charge, but in the quantum theory, the charge gets quantized as essentially an integer. And so there's always something that quantizes charge, and so for this Ramond-Ramond field in this higher dimensional theory, we need to understand that charge quantization. And the second feature is that this is a self-dual field. So we need to understand what that self-duality is. Okay. So this charge quantization, well, so the answer is that the charges, charges live in some K-theory of this X, which is, as I said before, since we're in this global quotient situation, this is the equivariant K-theory of the manifold X. So one of the kind of beautiful and initially somewhat surprising features of this Ramond-Ramond field is that the charges are quantized not by integral cohomology, which is how you might think of usual electromagnetism, but rather quantized by K-theory. And the more subtle point, but the point which is where this computation comes from, is this self-duality. And so maybe I'll explain a little bit about that self-duality but in the context of sort of Maxwell field, so this is a digression, on self-duality. And I want to explain it in the context of a Maxwell field on this 10 manifold. So the Maxwell field, we want to think of the field strength as being a two-form on X. This is the field strength. And if we were in a Lorentzian manifold, a nine-manifold space across one-dimensional time, but with Lorentz signature, then we would write down the classical equations would be the wave equation. In Euclidean space, these would be the Laplace equation, essentially, first-order version. But here we would get a wave equation in Minkowski signature, which would be these two equations. Those would be the 10-dimensional analog. If we did this in four dimensions, these would be exactly Maxwell equations. But these are Maxwell equations with no currents on the right. And classically, what we have is an electric current here. And the classical Maxwell equations would be precisely these in four dimensions. Now, in the quantum theory, we're also going to have a magnetic current. And we might just pretend that we had one in this classical theory just to illustrate. And the electromagnetic duality essentially exchanges the magnetic and the electric current, and simultaneously this F and star F. So you think of that as electromagnetic duality, that it's exchanging, and we're going to focus on the currents, that it really exchanges electric and magnetic currents. So notice, by the way, that we have that the currents are closed as differential forms. And, that's the conservation of charge when you see what the consequence of that is by Stokes' theorem. So that means that the currents are kind of geometric objects, right? When something is closed, it could represent some kind of cohomology class or some more geometric object that carries that cohomology class. And this equation says we should think of the field, the Maxwell field, as some kind of trivialization of the magnetic current. And so that's an interpretation that we want to keep in mind. Okay, so in this dimension, this magnetic current, well, that's a three-form, so we'll call it J3, and the electric current, that's a nine-form. And so what I want to do is think of formulating a sort of self-dual version . Well, obviously, this thing isn't self-dual because it exchanges J3 and J9. But to make it self-dual, I'll just do the silly thing of doubling everything. So in other words, we'll consider F, which is F2 and F8 together. Now, over here, the F8 was the star of F2, the Hodge star. But really, here, I want to think of them as independent. So F2 and F8 are independent. And similarly, this J would be J3 with J8 together. Nine. Right. And I should say that we usually have an A as well, which would be A1 and A7. And A is roughly the gauge field, whose field strength should be thought of as F. So it's like the connection, and F like the curvature. And, right. So, how do I want to point this out? Well, there's a pairing of, electric and magnetic, which occurs for any gauge field. You see, for any gauge field, we have a pairing of electric and magnetic. So, for example, the typical thing would be, supposing we had our 10 manifold and we had a 1 manifold in there, the world line of a particle, we would think of it in the, on a space-time situation, and then we could integrate over that world line this gauge field, A1, this connection, we would think of normally as a holonomy, a Wilson line. And we could think of that as being the integral over x of A wedge A1, wedge J9, right, where J9 is just the Poincaré dual to this one manifold. So this one manifold gives us, with respect to this original problem, would give us a magnetic, an electric current, and that electric current couples to the A, and that's the kind of term, if you write ordinary electromagnetism as an action principle, a Lagrangian theory, then you would encounter this. But one of the important points is that when we write it in the self-dual language, if I wrote the integral of x of A wedge J, and I asked that the thing be self-dual, meaning that this was the dual of that, then you would just see this thing two times. You would essentially see that coupling two times. And so in the self-dual case, we have to take this half. And taking this half is the crucial bit of extra structure that really drives this whole thing. Now, taking this half classically is just some simple manipulation with differential forms. We can divide by 2. But the crucial point is that we have to take the half and keep in mind this charge quantization. So in other words, we have to take this half and be working over the integers, because this charge quantization is something that has to do with the integers. And, well, in mathematics, we know how to take a half over the integers. That half over the integers, it has to do with having quadratic forms which refine a bilinear pairing. And so that's the crucial bit of structure that comes in when you have a self-dual field. And that's what ultimately gives the formula that we're trying to get. So, the situation, this pairing of electric and magnetic, we really see on a 12 manifold. And there are various pairings that we can see on 12, 11, and ultimately 10 manifold. But the simplest place to see it would be on a 12 manifold, where you see we have a 3 form and a 9 form. And if I wedge them together, we get a 12 form. And that's the place where I want to see it. And so really, instead of pairing these currents, I'm going to pair their cohomology classes, which are charges. So we'll let Q be Q3, Q9. This is in H3 of this M, now with integer coefficients, plus H9 of this M with integer coefficients. And of course, the bilinear form that pairs these, So if I have a Q1 and a Q2, and I want to pair the bilinear form, I want to think of integrating over M this, better not use that, Q and Q prime, then I'll have Q sort of cup product Q prime, and then integration over M really means pair with the fundamental class. That would be usually in topology. And this Q has two components, so this would be Q3 cup with Q prime 9 plus Q9 cup with Q prime 3 evaluated on the fundamental class. So that, in this case, would be the pairing between electric and magnetic. But the extra data that tells us that this thing is self-dual is going to be a map, theta, which basically takes one kind of current to the other kind. So it should take you should think of it as taking magnetic current to electric current. Well, in this case, the currents are both in the same group, H3 cross H9, mapping to H3 across H9. And in this case, we would take Q3 and Q9 and just map them to Q3 and minus Q9. So it's a very simple kind of map there. And it has the property that if I take this bilinear form and evaluate it on theta of Q in Q prime, then this thing is symmetric. Sorry, theta of Q and Q. Yeah, Q prime. This thing is symmetric. So I want to think of this as this theta is mapping really magnetic currents to electric currents in general. For a self-dual field, one of the ideas is that these magnetic and electric can be identified. That's the switch. So in a self-dual field, we have to be able to map from one to the other. And that's the role of this theta. And it has to be done in such a way that the standard pairing between electric and magnetic is symmetric now. And that's the first piece of data. And the second piece of data is a quadratic form Q. So that's defined on a single current. So that's a quadratic form with values in Z for on this 12 manifold. And in this case, it just takes Q3 cross Q9 and maps it into the product evaluated on the fundamental class. And now you can check that this form is really quadratic and that the associated bilinear form is the associated bilinear form is this is B. So the key property is that if I evaluate Q on the sum of two guys, Q plus Q prime, never mind the fancy Q's, and I subtract off the quadratic form on Q and the quadratic form on Q prime, and I add back the quadratic form at zero, then this is the bilinear form on Q and Q prime. So again, to say what a self-dual field is, I need to give this theta that maps from here to here in such a way that that's symmetric, and I need to give this quadratic form, which refines that.
Is that the symmetric bilinear on the right-hand side?
This is the, right, thank you. So that's theta of Q, Q prime, thank you. So the typical example you should think of, well, that's what I was just going to explain. So remark, if we just think of on Z, if we think of the bilinear form from Z cross Z to Z as being, it just takes an integer n and an integer n prime, and it gives us nn prime. Right? And supposing we want to take, now, so on the diagonal, that's n squared, and we want to take half n squared. Well, we can't take half n squared in the integers, but we can take Q from Z to Z, which just takes n. And so we can't take half n squared, but we can take half n squared plus n, for example. And so you can check that that satisfies this equation, that this is a quadratic refinement of that. So you should always think that the quadratic form that satisfies this, without the two in the equation, is taking half n squared. That's basically the idea. So this is a notion of a quadratic form, a quadratic refinement of a bilinear form. Okay. So there's more to this story, because we have to give something on an 11 manifold and with a certain compatibility. And then there's actually a theory of Hopkins and Singer that kicks in that tells you you get something on differential version of the theory, and so on. And so that will be behind the scenes here. But essentially, the computation that we want to do is topological. And so I'm not going to spell that out at the moment. So this was a kind of warm-up to tell you in the Maxwell theory, if instead of having a single field, I doubled it up by having the electromagnetic dual at the same time, that that's self-dual. And then we could think of it this way. By the way, if you think of it this way, then there's a certain SL2Z symmetry that you have in the Maxwell theory, which is much more transparent in that formulation. Okay, so back to this Ramon story. That was all. A digression. So remember that we have X compact, X10 compact, and we have sigma, this involution, and this is equivariantly spin. And, right. And so now we're going to take the Ramon-Ramon charge group, the thing that replaces this product over here of H3 cross H9, is going to be the degree zero KR theory of X. So, again, I'm not going to say what KR theory is, but I'll just remind you that can I do it over here? The K theory, we want to think of having vector bundles over X, which are complex vector bundles. That's what kind of object in K theory. And in KR theory, we also have a vector bundle over X, but together with, if we pull back the bundle E, then what we get is a lift of sigma. Well, if it lifted to E, then that would just be an equivariant complex vector bundle, right? That would be a sigma equivariant complex vector bundle. But instead, when I pull back by the involution, I get the complex conjugate. So it's a kind of twist of ordinary K theory, but where the involution conjugates. Okay. So that's the crucial kind of twist in KR theory. So notice, by the way, I should remind you maybe, that KO theory is a theory where, I'll just call it F, these are real vector bundles. So KO theory is a theory of real vector bundles. And indeed, supposing this involution acts trivially on X, if this involution acts trivially on X, then we're lifting it fiber by fiber, so it's a linear algebra construction in each fiber, and the involution is lifted to an involution that maps E to its complex conjugate, and it squares to the identity. It lifts as an involution. And so that, you see, is just a real structure on a complex vector space. So KR theory, when the involution acts trivially, that's just the same as KO theory. Okay, so these are the kinds of theories we're looking at. So we're looking at this KR theory on X, but as I just said, if the involution is trivial, that was the type 1 case, then we really get KO theory. So this is a kind of version of real K theory. It's got reality in it. Okay, and now I have to give you these two pieces of data. I have to give you this theta, which maps from magnetic to electric guys, and I have to give you this quadratic form Q. So the self-dual data, well, the first piece is this theta. So that has to map KR in degree zero on, well, it can map on X, which is our 10 manifold, but as I said, we're kind of going to work with this integer-valued quadratic form on a 12 manifold, and I'm going to hide a little bit what goes on in the other dimensions, but the essential topological point occurs in the 12-dimensional theory. And here we're going to map, this you should think of as a kind of magnetic current, and then we're going to map to KO in degree 8, which is where the electric current is. And the map takes, well, let me write it as E since I wrote it over there. It takes a bundle E, and it maps it to its complex conjugate. You see, its complex conjugate is, again, a bundle with a lift like that. You can easily see. But we had to shift from degree 0 to degree 8, and so we have to multiply by this element U to the 4, where U is, well, that's in really K2 of a point. That's called the bod element. And the important point is this U to the fourth is actually real. So this lifts to KO, 8 of a point. And it's the element that gives the Bott periodicity, isomorphism, in real K theory. So I put in the degree because that's somehow the right thing to do, but we could actually leave that off. So essentially this theta is just taking the complex conjugate of a bundle. And that means that the symmetric bilinear form is going to be the bilinear form which multiplies two elements, but it conjugates the first. So it would be E bar times E prime. And then we would integrate that over theta. So let me just tell you directly, rather than bilinear form, you can work it out, I'll tell you what this quadratic form is. So this quadratic form is going to map from kr0 of m to z. And so it has a rather interesting little description. So rather than write a single formula, I'm going to write a recipe for how you compute it. And I want to emphasize that the input into telling you the data that defines, the topological data that tells you what this Ramon-Ramon field is, are these two pieces of data. And the output is going to be that charge formula. But this is where the input is. So this is the input that sort of matches the high energy theory. Okay, so the quadratic form to compute Q I guess I call it Q of E. Then here are the steps. So the first step is we form theta V times E, which is U to the fourth times E bar E. And the times you should think of as tensor product, really. So the second step is we lift to KO theory of M, I guess in degree 8 because of the u to the fourth, but equivariant for sigma, or for the z mod 2. So this is a bundle which has, when I take sigma, these two e and e bar get exchanged. And so if you think of the map that just exchanges these, then you can easily see that, in fact, that gives you a linear lift, not an antilinear, but a linear lift of the z2 action. And you get a real structure. So I mean, the map which exchanges them is a real structure, and then that lift you can combine and get a linear lift. And this u to the fourth was already real, so that was okay. So this is a construction which gives you this lift to this KO group. And now we can integrate. So this is pi m, projection of m to a point. And so if we push forward by that, that's kind of integration, then we'll map from KO8, equivariant Z2, into, well, we're integrating over 12 manifolds, so we get to KO in degree minus 4, Z mod 2 on the point. So to do this integration, I need to have a spin structure. That's what I need, kind of orientation condition to integrate in KO. And because I'm doing it in this equivariant theory, I need an equivariant spin structure. And that's exactly the case I told you we're considering. So if we didn't have that case, we would have various twistings of these KO groups that would enter at this point. And they would have entered already in defining the Ramon-Ramon field. Okay. Now the next step, we use a map, iota, from KO minus 4 of a point, an isomorphism to the integers. Well, if you know your KO groups, the Bott song Z2, Z2, 0, Z, this is the Z at that point, 0, 0, 0, Z. So you know there is such an isomorphism. But in fact, that isomorphism is playing a certain role here. And I'll just say that any cohomology theory has what's called a Pontryagin dual theory. So there's a notion on generalized cohomology theories of taking a Pontryagin dual theory. And one of the beautiful features of KO and of K is that this theory is actually self-Pontryagin dual. And that self-duality of this cohomology theory is part of the story of the self-dual field in general, why you can use it to give the Dirac quantization condition on a self-dual field. So this particular choice of a map, not, for example, from degree zero, is crucial because it's part of the self-duality of KO. Well, if we do that, then at that point, we went from KO minus 4 to KO 0. And that's just the representation ring, the real representations of a cyclic group of order 2. So that couldn't be easier. We just have the trivial representation and the sine representation. So that's the real one-dimensional, non-trivial representation. And as a ring, if I square the sine representation, I get the trivial representation. So as a ring, I just get that. Okay, and the last step, that's a 4, this is 5, is take the coefficient of epsilon. So we can write the answer as A plus B epsilon inside here. and we just take the coefficient of epsilon. That's an integer. So there's the prescription, whatever it's worth. So one thing to say about this prescription is, now how long do you really want me to go on?
As long as you need to, and as long as we have patience.
All right. Well, I still see an even number of eyes open, so we'll go on a little bit further, so I can at least state the result. Right? It would be a shame not to get that far. Is it? Can I answer that at the end? I mean, ask me at the end, but let me not make that digression now. Maybe I should say. So a special case, which is type 1, where sigma is the trivial involution, then this kr, as I've said before, of m is just ko in degree 0 of m, and q of e, e is now thought of as a real bundle. This is what? Well, we actually take lambda 2 of e, the second exterior power of e, that's an operation in KO theory, and we simply integrate that over m. And, of course, this integral in KO theory, I should have said, has an interpretation in terms of Dirac operators. That's what the Atiyah-Singer index theorem says. And so, for example, here we would be taking the index of the Dirac operator on this 12-manifold M coupled to the second exterior power of a real bundle. So that's a function of a real bundle. And so that index is an integer, and that's what this quadratic form works out to be. So when you go through this exercise of seeing what the real structure is, this equivariant lift, and taking this coefficient of epsilon, the sine representation, then what you get is lambda 2. The coefficient, by the way, of 1 would have been sim 2 instead of lambda 2. Okay, and that, you can check, is a quadratic refinement of the bilinear pairing, which simply multiplies two bundles and integrates. Okay, so these things do have interpretations in terms of Dirac operators, but that index theorem is really not what we're using here. And that would enter in a different part of the story. Okay. So now I want to give... right. So now, recall that a quadratic function has a graph which is a parabola. So I figured I'm going over time, so we may as well get down to business here. So so here we go. I'm either slipping into the wrong lecture or something. But I think a quadratic function usually has a graph like that. And in fact, this is a quadratic function whose value at 0 is 0. And if you think about going through this process where E was the zero bundle, you would actually get zero out at the end. So we should think of this quadratic function as having a graph like this. And we should think of this horizontal axis, the input, as being the Ramond-Ramond charge. Okay. Well, if you have a quadratic form like that, that goes through zero, then there's one nice piece of information you might like to know, which is this point here. Right, so this is a point which tells us the axis of symmetry. So the quadratic form has an axis of symmetry. And this point here, this particular charge, is called mu. So this mu, which is in kr, then 0 of m, or of x, 10-manifold, is the, it's actually not defined on a 12-manifold, but a 10 is the center of the symmetry. Now, it turns out, and again, I think I better not try to explain at the moment, it turns out that this mu is the crucial thing which gives this charge formula. So, so part of the understanding of a self-dual field And this really has to do with sort of gauge invariance, ultimately, is that the RR field will, in the end, be a trivialization. Remember, I told you that the gauge field is a trivialization of the current, and this thing will be a trivialization of, well, it won't be actually a trivialization, but an isomorphism of, so the field F or A, I don't know what to call it, will be an isomorphism from this mu to some other current J, where this ends up being the current of D brain. Sure, the D brains. So I said D brains also give you a current. They give you a charge or a current for this Ramon-Ramon field. And in the end, what you have to have is that the current of these D brains has to live in a particular cohomology class. Its charge has to be this particular element. And that the Ramon-Ramon field is, in fact, an isomorphism from here to here. So again, this quadratic form picks out this non-zero cohomology class, and that tells you something about where the D-brains have to live, and then finally what this is. And the motivation for that statement has to do with, in the end, gauge invariance, that you want what you construct to be gauge invariant in the Lagrangian theory. It's a kind of Gauss law gauge invariance, again, in the Hamiltonian theory. So the simplest example of a quadratic form that gives you this, I'll just mention, is just on Riemann surfaces. It would be a quadratic form that maps line bundles, pick of a surface, into lines. And given a line bundle L, we would map it into the determinant of the Dirac operator on sigma coupled to L. And if we do that, then so we think of this line as a kind of quadratic function of L. Then you see this line has symmetries. I can scale on the line. I can have a C star action on the line. And that C star action on the line induces an action on this determinant line. So that C star action, that's kind of a flat gauge transformation. If we had a line bundle and we did that, that would be a flat gauge transformation. And where this restriction comes from here has to do, again, with flat gauge transformations of the Ramon-Ramon field. So here, the flat gauge transformations is just the scaling, and we know how it acts on the determinant line. It acts, if I scale by lambda, it acts by lambda to a power, the integer power, and that integer power is the index of Dirac, which is the degree of the line bundle plus 1 minus the genus. It's just the Riemann-Roch formula, so maybe it's d bar, let's say. So we just get a character, in other words, of C star, which is given by that integer. And that character is 0 precisely when this line bundle is a square, you know, in the component of Picard, which is the square root of the canonical bundle. So there's something better that happens at square roots of the canonical bundle, and that's that this scaling acts trivially. So that line is somehow better behaved than in the other components, and that's one of the reasons in the theory of surfaces that you see that component picked out. And it's that same principle, really, that's behind this. And that's the crucial point of this background charge, you see, because this background charge is telling us what we needed to cancel it, but this mu is kind of the background charge that's there. And so, you see, this is, I didn't quite give you a precise definition of mu, but I could. And so this is really a well-defined math problem. So we've finally done the exercise of an applied mathematician. We've extracted a math problem from this physical system. That's really what it is. So now we have to go solve the math problem. So that's where the theorem is. And right, so the precise statement. So we need one more preliminary, which is the remark that if I have kr of m or x or any space really is a module over the representation ring of z mod 2, all that says is if I have a particular lift of this involution, I can multiply it by negative 1, really, the sine representation. And recall this is the ring, z adjoint epsilon mod 1 minus epsilon squared. And so the theorem, we won't be able to calculate mu, but we'll only be able to calculate it in a localization. So we'll let S be the multiplicative set 1 minus epsilon to the n. where n is bigger than equal to 1, and we'll localize. So in other words, we're going to adjoin inverses of all the elements of S. And you should think of this as really just setting epsilon equal to negative 1. That's essentially what that localization does. You see, in this localized ring, I've inverted 1 minus epsilon. So what happens to 1 plus epsilon? Well, 1 plus epsilon is equal to 1 plus epsilon times 1 minus epsilon divided by 1 minus epsilon. But 1 plus epsilon times 1 minus epsilon, that's 1 minus epsilon squared over 1 minus epsilon. And 1 minus epsilon squared is 0. So 1 plus epsilon is 0 in this local ring, which means localized ring, which means epsilon is negative 1. So essentially what that is setting epsilon equal to negative 1. Or, if you like, you see, and also setting epsilon equal to negative 1 means I've inverted 2. I've inverted all powers of 2. Okay. So if I inverted 2 from the beginning, by the way, in this ring, then this ring is just the set of integer valued functions on 2 points. And what I'm doing is looking at the value at one of the points. That's localization, right? We look at, think of the ring as functions, and we look at it, the value on some subvariety. So there it's 1 point. Okay, so now, having that, I could say, at least the result in the form of a theorem. So now it's a theorem, it's really a theorem in equivariant K-theory, and it's not a hard theorem once you're all the way here. And so theorem is, well, in the setup, don't have to repeat it, so X10 is compact spin, sigma is a spin involution, let's say, so it lifts to have order 2 on the spinners, can't see anymore, and let's let I be the inclusion of the fixed point set. And nu over f, sorry, is the normal bundle. Now notice the normal bundle has an action of z mod 2, the involution x on the normal bundle. The involution x trivially on f, so it's just acting fiber by fiber. And since this is the fixed point set, it acts as negative 1 in each fiber. So it's just acting as negative 1 in each fiber. And then the formula is that mu is equal to 1/2 the push forward from the fixed point set of the formula side of the 1/2 times u to the 4th divided by the Euler class of the normal bundle. And then we have a certain sort of characteristic class f. And that's the formula. And this takes place in this localized version of kr 0 of x. So that's the formula. Okay. Where side of the 1/2 is the inverse of the Adams operation psi 2. And this class psi f is a KO theory, Wu class, I would say. Okay. So, so that's the theorem. And I don't think I want to really go much further, so I'm happy, of course, to explain. So I haven't really explained what those things are. I'm happy to explain in detail, but maybe the point is more to give you kind of an overview of what we've done here is, anyway, once we have this data, as I said, of specifying where the Ramon-Ramon charges live, specifying this quadratic form, and then we have a well-defined problem to compute this axis of symmetry, which is this kind of background gravitational charge, where that's going to live. And so doing the exercise, we find this formula. So what this formula says is that that this charge is actually localized. It's pushed forward to this fixed point set. So it's the push forward of something that's supported on the fixed point set. On the fixed point set, this KR theory restricts to be KO theory. It's KO theory, but with two inverted, because we're in this localized situation. So because I've inverted two, this psi operation is essentially squaring on Lyme bundles. And when you invert two, you can take a square root of Lyme bundles. And so that's what this thing is. And this formula is proved, quite simply, once you know this idea that inverting, localizing like this in equivariant cohomology rings localizes classes to the fixed point set. That's an old principle in equivariant cohomology of any kind called the localization theorem. And so once we're willing to invert two, then we can see this formula. So it's not hard to see, for example, when F is just flat and when nu is also trivial, then all we're going to get is a number. And you'll see pretty quickly from this formula the standard number, which is the formula the physicists have for D-brain charge. But when things are curved, they also, as I said, from string theory, have a formula. And that's the formula that one ends up duplicating. So as I say, the proof, the computation, really goes from the fixed point theorem in equivariant cohomology. And maybe I'll stop there, and I'm happy to explain a little bit more details on any of those points. Thank you.
Are there any questions?
So the physicists really got that formula of the inverse of the Adams operation?
No. Well, no, they don't. Right, I should say that the special case of type 1 is something that I worked out, and that involves understanding this Wu class, and that's something I worked out with Mike Hopkins. It's written in an appendix to some paper from a while ago called Generalized Maxwell Equations or something like that. But what the physicists see is, you see, I told you way back that we had this term that was like a half of the integral over x of the field times the what would be the Ramon-Ramon field times the current, and the half because it was self-dual. Well, that formula is what becomes Q of the Ramon-Ramon field, this quadratic form. So I told you that quadratic form was like taking a half. So this Q is in there, but this, or F I called it, but this this Ramon-Ramon field is a map from this mu to this J. So anyway, when you work out in differential forms what this ends up being, and because of that mu that's there, and because it's pushed forward from the fixed point set, this ends up getting written in a quite concrete form. Namely, it gets written just as before we had, you know, in electromagnetism, this is the integral of A over the world sheet. So this thing becomes the integral over the fixed point set of A times something. And the something that gets put there, well, I'm not putting the contribution from the J, but the sort of gravitational piece that gets put there is something that looks like the square root of the Herzebruch-L polynomial, but applied to the curvature of F over 4 divided by the square root of the L polynomial applied to the curvature of the normal bundle over 4. Now, that's the formula that you'll find in the physics literature, in particular in that paper of Skruk and Cerrone. And Jacques showed me that formula several years ago. And it was very confusing, because after I looked at normalizations and so on, then this looked very much, this L is the Herzebruch polynomial. But it wasn't the usual Herzebruch thing. The usual Herzebruch thing is x over the, gosh, I've forgotten, hyperbolic tangent of x over 2. Do I have that right? What?
I think so.
Something like that. That's the usual L. But this thing, L of R over 4, I think this is would be L of R over 2 maybe or something. And, you know, maybe we have to worry about the 2 there. But this thing was somehow with, you know, 4s, x over 4. And that didn't correspond to anything really I knew. On the other hand, at that point I'd already written this paper, this appendix with Mike, where we discussed this Wu class. This Wu class, I should say, is gotten by just thinking that if I take the map that takes a class X and takes it to psi 2, the Adams operation applied to X, and then integrate it over M or whatever, then this is a linear function of x. So this has to be written as the push forward in M of x times something. I guess this is f, the fixed point set. Okay, because it's linear. And the something that goes here is what I'm calling this class psi of f. So remember that in cohomology, if we take the Steenrod square in mod 2 cohomology and we integrate right on the fundamental class of a manifold, that's the class times the Wu class. Right. So this is exactly an analog in KO of the Wu class, where the Steenrod operation is replaced by the Adams operation. And so that enters because essentially what happens when you look at the associated bilinear form of this quadratic thing I told you about, then you get this Adams operation. So to kind of figure out the formula, you have to end up inverting it. So I knew about that side of the 1/2 and the formula, but somehow we had never written it out in terms of its Chern character quite in the form where I would have immediately seen actually these things and I would have recognized it. But anyway, in doing this project, we recognized that. And so so it really comes from this Wu class in combination with some A hats, square roots of A hats that they use to normalize and other kinds of things. But anyway, you do get out of that formula, this formula, by some kind of procedure. So you really do recover the formula they write. So that formula, of course, this one's better. This formula is over the integers with two inverted. That formula, of course, is over the reals. But, you know, I don't know what happens if you don't invert two. For example, it's possible that there's some pieces of this charge not localized on the fixed point set that are torsion of order two. That would be quite interesting, actually. But I have no idea how you would compute that. I mean, this localization theorem is powerful, but we have to invert two to do that.
Well, thank you very much.
Push this button that says erase.